A lot of fans, I think, don't take the idea of real support as seriously as we do, because it's just, you know, it's what I learned at Imagineer Tour because I had to. And then really the main thing was that, you know, you see an awful lot of stuff go wrong. You see a lot of stuff go right, but the stuff that goes wrong is really, really important. And then you just start to be able to pattern match. What are you actually looking for? Like, what are the best leading indicators over time of companies that are going to make it, especially within an esoteric vertical like water? And that means that the team is really, really important. You need to have people that either through radical founder market fit or a radical amount of work who have made sure that there is no gap between the perception of reality and the actual reality of a market. Enlight Energy, you've got a reasonably long sales cycle. It's quite an engaged, involved technical sale. But when you get to the end of that technical sale, you've got a $550,000 ASP with a 55% gross margin, 50% of which is 50% of the selling price is taken up front. So you've got very, very little working capital needs. You've got pretty spectacular overall performance indicators. So that actually ends up with a really, really strong business case, both for the customers and for Enlight themselves. So it's an amazing value sharing issue. And then often customers buy more than one. So you end up with these huge contracts. And so, okay, if it's, you know, taking anywhere between 9 to 15, sometimes at a stretch, 18 months, like what is coming off the end of the conveyor belt is worth waiting for. And then the other thing that we think that we mean by pricing and velocity is that often people are like, yeah, sales cycles ages, so it doesn't, like, it really doesn't matter if you've got somebody who really understands how to architect a sales funnel, because what is relevant is not the length of the conveyor belt. It's what happens when stuff starts falling off the end. Because if you have a really long conveyor belt and then you have stuff falling off the end of regularity, with regularity, especially if the unit economics of that stuff that's falling off is really tasty, like what you have is a moat, because it's going to take everybody else the same amount of time to be able to start that engine. But once you have that engine started, you have a built-in lead time. So not only the time it would take for other people to create an Enlight's case, an engine functioning at anywhere between 60 to 80% efficiency, which, so the moat is literally physics. Like, not only do they have to build that thing, they have at least a year and a half in the market before they can get to any kind of commercial traction. That is awesome. That's amazing. Like, you just have to get through it.
If you were forced today to go start your own water tech company, you couldn't be an investor anymore. You had to go build the company yourself. What problem would you go and solve?
I would go and drive a bus through the water testing market. It's basically populated by incumbents that take about 2 to 2.5 weeks to turn around a water test. And when they do, they give it to you to 9 decimal places. For the illusion of accuracy, but it's almost always wrong when you actually hold it up to a. It's insane. But just businesses where people have been able to harvest cash for ages while sucking, like, are really annoying. And there are a few examples of them, but that's the one that I would like to drive a coach and horses through, as they say in the old country.
Welcome back to Clean Techies, the number one podcast for climate tech entrepreneurs. Today, I had the chance to interview the one and only King of Water VC, yep, Tom Ferguson from Burnt Island Ventures, the leading VC specifically focused on investing in water technology globally. Tom's career path demonstrates the value of compounding presence, as Soma likes to call it. He started his career in environmental consulting with ERM, dealing with a lot of water issues. Then after Harvard Business School, he ended up landing at Imagine H2O, the first and I believe largest ecosystem in the world supporting founders in the water tech space. Then after that, he ended up founding Burnt Island Ventures. You know, all of these things have been in water, leading him to compound his network and knowledge deeper and deeper. Today, Burnt Island Ventures has a collection of some of the best water startups around the world, and the compounding continues. So today, there were a lot of very interesting, cool things said, but I think one thing really stood out to me, and that was his advice on planning for a slow sales cycle. He said, if you do things right, just because the sales cycle is longer doesn't mean the return cycle of the fund has to be longer. You just need to plan for it as a founder. He also talked about how a longer sales cycle, if you do it correctly, is actually a huge moat for your business. So there's a lot of other really amazing gems in there. I'm really excited to be able to share this with you. And hey, before we start, if you're not already a subscriber, do us a favor and drop us a follow on Substack and YouTube. We put this content out each week for free, so all we ask in return is that you follow. Yes, I know we could seek affirmation elsewhere, but we really, really like to get it from our favorite people, climate entrepreneurs. Thanks a ton and enjoy the show.
All right. Welcome to the show, Tom. How's it going today?
Very well, Silas. Thank you so much for having me. It's a pleasure to be here.
Yeah, it's a pleasure to have you on. You guys are doing some really interesting things. So let's get straight into it. I guess tell us a little bit about who you are and what you do.
Sure. My name's Tom Ferguson. You know, I'm from the British Isles. I'm the managing partner of Burnt Island Ventures, and we invest in early stage water companies. Our job is to find, fund, and support the best water entrepreneurs in the world. Prior to that, I ran the accelerator at an amazing nonprofit organization called Imagine H2O for 5.5 years, which basically gave me the kind of training ground to at least, I felt, at least have the license to set this up in 2020. Before that, I was a slightly useless MBA for hire in a couple of early stage companies, did my MBA, and prior to that, I was a sustainability consultant with the phenomenal group at Environmental Resources Management, who are now part of the KKR family. I chose sustainability very, very clearly in 2008 and have been doing it ever since. And now it is, as if by magic, 2024. I don't know how that happened, but it did, and here we are.
How do you define water tech or water? You say you invest in the best water entrepreneurs in the world. How do you define that?
Yeah. So we sort of think about this a couple of different ways, but probably the easiest thing to think about is the water cycle. So take yourself back to grade school. You know, what happens to the water? Where it comes off the oceans, up it goes up the mountains, then it falls down as rain. Where does it go? It goes to the ground, it goes to surface water, or it goes to reservoirs, or it goes straight out of the sea, whatever it is. Along that road, it gets used for a variety of different purposes. Either it is just stored, or it's used in agriculture, or it's used in water utilities, or whatever it might be. So if you follow it around, anything that acts on that, or acts within that value chain, is something that's within our purview. So we invest in anything that allows water and wastewater services to be provided at the right quality, quantity, price, place, and time. Water is a bit of a weird substance in that it is very much place-based. It has to be at the right price. You can't have water that is too expensive, right? For it to be useful. If it's too expensive for people to be able to have access to it, it's not useful for anything from, you know, drinking to making semiconductors, right? All of these things need to be right for it to be able to be useful in its chosen end use. So we really look at that. And it covers a lot of ground. You know, we're looking at everything from agriculture and aquaculture to drinking water and wastewater on the municipal side, we're looking at commercial, industrial. We do look at oceans. There's a huge amount of water of CDR happening in water, so we're bringing that within our circle of competence. So we cover a lot of ground, and that's, you know, this is $3.6 trillion a year worth of activity. This is not a niche.
To clarify, so this is also across hardware and software. It's not absolutely just software or hardware company.
Yeah, this is a physical molecule. They're not allowed to be afraid of hardware. It's really important that you've got that within your
fair play
remit.
And you mentioned that you chose sustainability pretty early on. So like, can you talk about your reason for doing that, or why that, where that influence came? Because it seems as though you did make a very kind of conscious effort in your entire career to be in that space.
Yeah, I the plan from the age of 10, where I'm the youngest kid, so I wanted to be an actor. I wanted to be on stage, and I wanted to have everybody looking at me, and I wanted to get applause every evening, and read into that what you will about my psyche. But I graduated into the jaws of the financial crisis. Very ironic in that I spent quite a lot of my undergrad studying financial crises and sort of failed to notice that one was materializing around my ears. It really was very embarrassing. It really was very embarrassing. And I graduated into it, and suddenly, like, everybody in acting moved down two rungs because all of the advertising revenue, which the performing arts survives on, just evaporated. And so, like, I got this piece of paper that said I could kind of think, essentially. And I was like, well, do I go and, like, eat those 2 years, or is there actually something that potentially I could, like, put my shoulder to the wheel of that isn't, like, someone else? I love acting. I still do. I still love the theater. But I figured that there were other places where maybe I could help. And I'd always been aware of climate issues, but I couldn't see anybody that I knew that was going expressly to go and work on climate stuff. So I figured that, you know, maybe the climate needed a hand. And the best way to do that was to go and really luck into an amazing job with the sustainability and climate change team at ERM. And then that 3.5 years gave me an amazing vantage point into all sorts of stuff within climate change and sustainability, but including water.
Hey guys. Sorry for the interruption. I just need a few seconds because Soma and I have two quick favors to ask. Putting out the show each week takes about 15 to 20 hours between us, so it's a lot of effort. And it would mean the world to us if you would leave a review and mention your favorite episode. Secondly, if you're not already, go over and subscribe to the podcast on Substack. The content is free, but if you like hanging out with us each week, maybe we're even the kind of guys you'd like to buy a coffee for on occasion, consider becoming a paid subscriber. For the cost of one lavender latte a month, you can help us immensely. Thank you for tuning in consistently and helping us to share our guests' stories. Now back to the show.
Yeah, obviously it's a huge part of it. I guess I'm very curious, how did your time at Imagine H2O really influence you to go? I mean, because the next step straight after that, at least according to what I can find, was that you went and started BIV, yeah. Burnt Island Ventures. So like, how did that influence you to make that change?
Yeah, it was an extraordinary opportunity. Very kindly afforded me by the excellent Scott Bryan and the rest of the team at H2O. But Scott was a real, he was a fantastic boss for 5.5 years. It was really profound. This doesn't happen without my time at Imagine H2O. The accelerators themselves, I think, are actually really good training grounds for this business because they force you to do a couple of things. Firstly, you can't help but have your N get really high really fast. I mean, that can kind of happen as an analyst. But you're sort of crunching a lot of different stuff and you're not actually really, you're only maybe engaging with some of the portfolio companies that are invested in, but not really. But when you're running an accelerator, you know, people are there, they are involved with you. They're coming in and figuring out programming, right? All of this stuff that accelerators do forces you to engage with the mode of company building in a way that is relatively unique. I mean, I was the third hire, and then I was kind of the second relatively soon after it. No, hopefully correlation, not causation. And so it was Scott and I at the beginning, and then I was joined by my fantastic colleague, Nimesh Modak, who's the advisor for us now. And we really just, like, we had to bust our ass to build a product that really top quality entrepreneurs wanted to engage with. And so that really, like, you know, I mean, everyone always takes the piss out of VCs for, like, oh, let me know how I can be helpful. Literally, we only had being helpful as part of our product. And we had to take that idea incredibly seriously. So what that gave us was, and gave me, was, I think, a kind of really interesting muscle memory about, okay, this company's in front of me. Like, actually, how do I make a difference in addition to the capital that I'm going to provide? So I learned that bit first. And then I learned the capital provision. Because in many ways, that kind of capital provision, like, it's not easy, right? And what's really hard about it is that you only know whether you're really good at it, like, many, many, many years later, right? Yeah. The initial structure of deals is incredibly important. But a lot of funds, I think, don't take the idea of real support as seriously as we do, because it's just, you know, it's what I learned at Imagine H2O, because I had to. And then really the main thing was that, you know, you see an awful lot of stuff go wrong. You see a lot of stuff go right, but the stuff that goes wrong is really, really important. And then you just start to be able to pattern match. What are you actually looking for? Like, what are the best leading indicators over time of companies that are going to make it, especially within an esoteric vertical like water? So it couldn't have been a better training ground. The last thing I'll say is that it did provide me a front row seat onto a data set that pretty much no one else in the world had at that time, which was the number and quality of entrepreneurs that were starting businesses within water. And there'd been a tectonic shift by 2020. We were refusing people into our accelerator in 2020 that probably would have walked in about 18 months prior. And that to me was the why now. That was the why now for starting a seed fund in water, because other people have gone for it and it's kind of mixed results. And there have always been great founders. A lot of them are involved with us. There have always been great founders, but you'd never quite had a critical mass. And in 2020, that changed. And that's what's allowed us to, I think, made a pretty strong start in fund one of building a portfolio that I think a lot of VCs would be proud of.
Do you think that change in 2020 was specifically correlated in any way to the pandemic, or just kind of happened that's where the critical mass reached?
No, we did. I'd started to notice it in 2019, and I don't have a good reason for why it was happening. I think it's just that in all things in water, people often ask us, what's the inflection point? What's going to really change people's minds about water for us to all get scared enough about the Mad Max future that we're really going to finally get it? And the answer is nothing. Like, if we were really going to get this, we would have got it by now. We would have got it in 2014 with Flint. We still haven't fixed Flint. a decade later. But the constant drumbeat, the drip feed, yes, already there are lots of water jokes that you can see. The drip feed of changes, of support, of the talent coming in, the money that is being matched with that talent, the outsized commercial success that's happening, the public dollars that are finding its way to water, the upgrading in the support for the markets, even though we're miles behind where we should be, especially compared to the kilowatt hour, the gallon getting the Nord, and it drives me absolutely insane. It's one step in front of the other, and it's like that old Carl, what's his face, who writes for the New York Times, who's got the ladder that looks like some very small incremental steps, and then when you look from the beginning of the staircase to the end, it's actually a huge change. That's really is what we're in the middle of it in water. There's going to be big stuff for sure, but there are going to be bigger steps than others for sure, but we're just getting it over time because we don't have a choice. This is too important. There's no way we're not going to get it. We're just going to get it incrementally. We're at a really interesting part of that that journey now.
When you were starting BIV, like obviously we kind of know how it turned out. We know what you ended up with essentially. Tell us about the unsaid things, like what were the other things you consider, maybe different angles, or just the things that are usually not talked about in terms of actually getting that started, the difficult things that nobody likes to share.
I think it's a bit of a weird one, this, in that I think this came from a kind of relatively entrepreneurially honest place, in that I just saw the architecture of an argument that was so obvious to me that it was a question of writing it down and then talking to a lot of people and seeing who agreed with me. And in the end, 99 people did. About 251 didn't. But that's not a bad hit rate for the first time around. Nobody told me I was an idiot, which is great, because nobody likes to be told that you're an idiot. I think a lot of people raised their eyebrows at it. Is this like, this sounds niche. And as I said earlier, like whether or not you say it's 1.4 trillion in annual spend a year or 3.6 trillion as global water intelligence do about the capital employed annually in water security globally, this isn't a niche. This is water. This is the bottom of Maslow's hierarchy of needs. It's the number one thing that we deal with, whether or not you are in Ankara or Anchorage, right? It's what you deal with. This isn't a niche. This is profoundly important. And in the context of climate change, it is only getting more scarce. But it's just supply and demand. It's inevitable. It's just when did we jump on the train? What's our timing like? That is open for discussion for sure. But the fact that water is going to be a commercially vastly important theme for the next 4, 6, 8, 10 decades is incontrovertible in my mind. So there wasn't a lot of shade thrown at me for that. And then the obvious thing for me was that people were that could have thrown shade at me, is that, I work for a nonprofit accelerator, but I haven't really structured deals before. I've done some personal deals on purpose to be able to do it, but nobody really, maybe they said, we'd like you to, you're a bit early and you can do the fund two and the fund three. And then of the stuff that's ugly that people don't really talk about, I mean, even fundraising, a lot of people are not backed by it, but I really like it. It's really weird. It is weird because, I love this story. I love this story. And you feel like you're working on a secret that's hiding in plain sight. And even if someone says no, or even if the call is really short, that's one person of means, one more person of means who's at least had, somebody with my degree of conviction sit in front of them and try and explain to them why water's a good idea. Even if it changes someone's attitude by one degree, or they look at their tap something slightly differently the next morning, great. This is all incremental and good. But that's not to say it's not wildly difficult and there aren't, some things that, we would like to have done differently. But I think we were thoughtful in the way in, and it served us well.
Is there a particular story behind the name of the fund?
Yeah. I think you're doing the video behind me. This is a small painting given to me by my parents of the Burnt Islands. They are a group of islands on the west coast of Scotland. I know it sounds like I'm sort of, oh, the world's going to be on fire. It's a useful name in that it begs the question. People do latch onto it, and I think that's really important. But the reason I chose it is that it kind of reminds me of home. These are three islands that sit in the middle of my favorite view in all the world, above Tillebruch. This is a body of water in between the island of Bute and the mainland, and it's stunningly beautiful. And it's a rest stop as we go past. Very small, it's just a pullover lay-by, basically. But it just feels, every time we see it, it feels like the gateway to kind of where I grew up on the west coast of Scotland. And I just wanted to, like, names are really important. You think about them all the time. So that's kind of where it comes from. So it's related to the sea, even though we don't do a ton of ocean stuff. We know a lot of people who do. But maybe one day our destiny will be brought together by these islands sitting in a body of salt water rather than fresh water.
No, I think it's quite interesting. I mean, a lot of people picking names of things, like, it's like they joke, you just throw it in a clean tech name generator and something comes out, right? This totally. Doesn't seem like that, right? It sounds very different, which is why I was curious. I guess out of all of your experience, what were, maybe you already mentioned this, but what were the things that you think most set you up to become a good investor? At least, you know, it seems as though, I mean, obviously you said it takes a while to figure out if you're good at it, but yeah. It seems as though you're doing pretty well.
Yeah, exactly.
What do you think prepared you for this the most?
This is going to sound like sacrilege, but my MBA was really useful. I know in the tech industry, it's like great to hate on MBAs and they all suck. And all they want to do is like be consultants and in a tech company, like, why would you need them? They're all terrible, you know, all this crap. It's rubbish. The people I went to my business school with were absolutely phenomenal. And they've done an amazing array of really, really interesting things. And the way in which I was taught to think about businesses and things that were deeply unpopular in 2021 and now magically become popular again, things like unit economic. It's just, you know, like really understanding how to build the guts of a reasonable business. Not only that, all sorts of different businesses, right? Going everywhere from the largest public equities to real estate to, I spent a lot of time in energy, just enough to find that I wasn't, you know, I was a sustainability guy, but I didn't find energy hugely interesting. Maybe because I thought it was like a little bit played out. Now that is going to be like hugely sacrilegious, I think. Because we were on a scale moment and there's a huge amount of work left to do, and I don't mean it in the wrong way and I don't want to offend anybody, but just on a personal level, it just gave me a huge amount to think about it. But then the other stuff is just like is reading. One of my first job out of I really had the MBA beaten out of me. My first job out of my fancy business school, I had to get up at 5:45 in the morning and hop on my bike down to the bars and then go down to South San Francisco, bike up the hill to just underneath the South San Francisco sign to a middle school where I did a time and motion study of the installation of a 12 classroom building by hand. So I had a hard hat, boots, the whole lot, high-vis jacket, and I took 11,500 data points by hand. To essentially answer the question of like why is this taking longer and being more expensive than we think it is. So I had the data points and all of the notes about what happened with each panel of the installation of these flat pack buildings that were going in. That was unbelievably helpful. Because firstly, like, taught me that the world didn't owe me anything at all. That actually I can end up doing the least. I actually also had a seriously unsexy job in the summer in between my two years of business school. I was literally looking for chicken shit in the UK. It was awesome. I ended up in an abattoir in my last week, literally looking for blood. Anaerobic digestion is a very strange business. So, but what that taught me was that firstly, the world didn't owe me anything. Secondly, the delivery of a value proposition happens at the sharp end, that you really, really need to understand the specifics of getting the value proposition into the hands of your customer. And sometimes that takes 11,500 data points by hand, but usually kind of like what's happening in the fancy office and what's happening, especially in hardware, what's happening in the world that is just a question of putting one foot in the other, and it's the hard yards and it's the knife fight in the phone box, like whatever it is. Like, the world is really complicated. It is meaningless until you get your value proposition actually into the hands of your customer. But like, even then, I would have no idea what I was learning and while I was doing that, I did an awful lot of listening to an awful lot of podcasts, and that's where I discovered Morgan Housel and Trent Griffin and like a whole bunch of other people that were just they just seemed to me to be really sensible, and they were really good at highlighting other people who were really sensible. Patrick O'Shaughnessy, incredibly important, a touchstone for a whole bunch of different reasons. And I was just opened up to this world of kind of company building, some of which I agreed with, almost a lot of which I agreed with, some of which I didn't think was sensible. And it was the beginning of putting in place, I think, the mental kind of architecture that then I was able to underlay while I was working with all of these companies at Imagination to try and figure out what was possible, what was the sensible approach to company building, even though sensible amongst the canon of VC, right, is the enemy. Like, what you're looking for is unsensible. What you're looking for is Uber, like the strangers climbing into strangers' cars and that not being a suicidal idea, like turning up into someone's apartment to go and stay, right? And that not also being a suicidal idea. It's that stealism of the, you know, sounds like a bad idea, it is a good idea, and then you get a sort of, you know, $1 billion company. But yeah. I've always been attracted to the idea of sensible companies. Anyway, so there was kind of a lot to it, but I would point to those two, like my MBA and then listening to an awful lot of smart people who were kind enough to build in public.
Nice. Very nice. Okay, that's great. So we understand the remit is water. Do you invest at any particular stage of company or throughout the entire life cycle?
Yeah, we're looking to be as early as possible. Well, what we say our kind of job is that the moment a really, really smart person has an idea that has something to do with the water sector, and they go to their terminal and they say, well, VC for water, we need to be there about 15 seconds after they've had the idea. So we need to be really, really, really early. There's a bit of a weird setup in that you can have your cake and eat it too in water because nobody gets it, right? You don't have a huge amount of like price pressure. You also have to be very careful about pricing when you're getting into deals in this for reasons that we can go into. But really that means that we're at the pre-seed and the seed. We do a little bit of Series A, especially as you go through the deployment period. It can be a reasonable idea when you actually look at the maths to spend a little bit of time later in the company life cycle when you've got a little bit less time to run. But we're squarely at the seed. We want to be as far up the stage as we possibly can. But we are also raising an opportunity fund to be able to invest in the Series B and beyond, just because there is an awful lot of talent that is graduating.
Mm-hmm. Okay, got it. And so, you know, with most, I guess, generally speaking, VC, there's a lot of things people talk about is team timing and the technology. In water specifically, while doing diligence, what are the other things that are really particular you have to focus on?
So we've got to think, all of that is important. It's funny, people talk about the venture triangle. And they're all important. They really are. We are very, very much focused on the team side of things. So water is a relatively esoteric market. I actually would argue it's no more esoteric than other verticals, whether you're talking about fintech or insurtech or consumer or like you're just standardized B2B SaaS. It's just other people understand those verticals and there's no one that understands water. It's no more complicated than anything else. It's just that nobody understands it. So people find it hard to underwrite and it looks scary and terrible and slow and regulated and all this nonsense that people throw at. But you do have to be careful of a couple of things. So the bad things in VC happen in the gap between reality and people's perception of reality. And again, water is misunderstood. The gap tends to be a lot wider in water. So people will be like, yeah, I found out on a podcast that like the leakage rate in California out of the pipes is 21%. And California is a desert. And I'm going to go and fix that. It's like, great. Thank you. It's awesome. But there are 124 different leak detection companies out there at the moment. You have a really good reason why you're going to win. And that means that the team is really, really important. You need to have people that either through radical founder market fit or a radical amount of work who have made sure that there is no gap between the perception of reality and the actual reality of the market. You also have to be very, very careful about the pace of change in a market. There are reasons. There can be often like really quite precipitatory reasons why there is going to be an inflection. But a lot of people think that stuff in water is going to change faster than it does. I mean, the tricky thing about that side of things is that you need to be extremely careful all the way down. Because you can compensate for a slow pace of change, but you have to compensate through radical unit economics, and that can be pretty difficult to find. The other thing you also have to be really careful of, because, and again, I think this is probably the same in all sorts of other verticals, I just don't spend any time on it. Like, I think we as humans are inertia monsters. I don't think we want to do anything different ever about anything, unless we are essentially forced to. And that means that, like, the alternative to what we're doing has to be so good as to be unignorable. And especially when you're operating like a wastewater utility, for example, which is actually best understood as an organism, not a machine, to change something within that setup, it has to be so much better that you have to be, it has to be borderline a fireable offense not to install it. And that's even before you get all of this, into all of the challenges around being able to put it in place, all the complexities around being able to put it in place. So it's this idea of the margin of safety on the degree of improvement is a really important one. And then we try to stay away from things that are crowded. We had a really, really fun top of the funnel session this morning, just as the eclipse was going by. I didn't have my glasses, so I missed the eclipse. Isn't that sad? But I saw one in 1999, so it's fine. But we had three companies that were in a space that we'd never, like, hadn't even thought of. And that's where really, really interesting things happen. So we're looking for huge surprises. But otherwise, just, you know, we're just looking for companies that make a huge amount of sense, that you don't need to have a leap of faith to be able to imagine them becoming very, very large indeed. And that sounds an awful lot like the rest of VC to us.
Yeah, I think it's quite interesting. You touched on a question I wanted to go over, so maybe just kind of get your final thoughts on it, which is one of the points that you have on your website, which is, I think you said, you call it pricing in velocity.
Yeah.
I just found that to be probably the most interesting of those five things. And you talk about, hey, how fast are things going to change, et cetera. Yeah. So can maybe talk on that for the water space, but I think people listening apply this to other things in hardware too.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah, absolutely. And you know, it's funny, the five things, four of which are boring. so the one that is interesting in this area. So pricing and velocity. Everyone's always scared of slow. And I think that's really dumb. Like, infrastructure SaaS is slow. You know, people don't bat an eyelid of, like, having very long sales cycle for software. And that's because you're compensated by relatively large contracts when you're done. And that's just a fairly universal, like, piece of logic, isn't it? It's that if you're going to wait for something for a long time, it better be worth it. So, like, if you're going to be slow, what pricing and velocity means, a good example is Enlight Energy, right? So Enlight Energy, you've got a reasonably long sales cycle. It's quite an engaged, involved technical sale. But when you get to the end of that technical sale, you've got a $550,000 ASP with a 55% gross margin, 50% of which is 50% of the selling price is taken up front. So you've got very, very little working capital needs. You've got pretty spectacular overall performance indicators. So that actually ends up with a really, really strong business case, both for the customers and for Enlight themselves. So it's an amazing value sharing issue. And then often customers buy more than one. So you end up with these huge contracts. And so, okay, if it's, you know, taking anywhere between 9 to 15, sometimes to the stretch, 18 months, like, what is coming off the end of the conveyor belt is worth waiting for. And then the other thing that we think that we mean by pricing and velocity is that often people are like, yeah, sales cycles ages, so it really doesn't matter if you've got somebody who really understands how to architect a sales funnel, because what is relevant is not the length of the conveyor belt. It's what happens when stuff starts falling off the end. Because if you have a really long conveyor belt and then you have stuff falling off the end of regularity, with regularity, especially if the unit economics of that stuff that's falling off is really tasty, like, what you have is a moat, because it's going to take everybody else the same amount of time to be able to start that engine. But once you have that engine started, you have a built-in lead time. So not only the time it would take for other people to create, in Enlight's case, an engine functioning at anywhere between 60 to 80% efficiency, which, so the moat is literally physics. Like, not only do they have to build that thing, they have at least a year and a half in the market before they can get to any kind of commercial traction. That is awesome. It's amazing. Like, you just have to get through it. And on the other side of things, if things are really quick, yeah, you can be much more permissive about it. But, like, of all of the rocks that people throw at the water sector, it's slow. Actually, slow can be a real advantage as long as you think about it correctly.
Mm-hmm. I mean, does that affect necessarily how you invest or the fund size? Because, I mean, typical life cycle, maybe you have to invest, they have to have a longer runway, or they have to extend the money they've raised for a longer period of time. Like, does it actually have any material effect on how they run the company?
Yeah, you would think so. And it's a good question. I mean, there are two sides of it, a material effect on how they run the company. Yes, absolutely. You need to organize yourself around this fact, right? You have to make sure that this makes sense and you are turning it into an advantage. And for us, okay, if you're going to have like a really long sales cycle and we've got a, you know, our liquidity window is opening in 7 to 10 years time, and you've got a kind of relatively short window to be able to really get yourself into a commercial momentum that somebody's going to really sit up and take notice of, whether that's from the, you know, energy or the infrastructure private equity side of things or whatever it might be. You've got to be careful. You don't necessarily want to invest in that company too early at the end of your deployment period, because then you've only got like 4 years of runtime until your window opens. And that's not quite going to be touch and go that you're going to be able to get that revenue, you know, up there to like when you impose the multiple on it, that you're going to be able to get the you're going to get the MOIC that you're really looking for. So there are some things that imposes it on the kind of fund structuring. And then, yeah, in terms of like running the company itself, it has to be built around that fact. If you're going to be selling a complex product, you better be looking at that straight in the face. But like Enline did, 9.5 million in bookings last year. We think they're going to be touching, you know, 18 to 20 this year. And you don't have to go too far to be able to extrapolate that out to some really, really interesting multiples. I'm just very, very glad that we got into it when we did, which was relatively early in 2022.
Mm. So just to clarify, your fund time horizon is not different than most funds?
No.
Oh, okay.
No, we've got essentially a 10-year fund, and then, you know, we want to have the trust with our LPAC, and so for every year extension it's just with the agreement of the LPAC, which is a very standard fund structure. I mean, other people want to do like 14 to 16 years, like whatever it is. Look, first-time fund, first-time manager. Okay, I was raising in 2021, which is basically about the only time that like a first-time fund, first-time manager would be able to raise a fund in water. That fact is not lost on me. But I also wanted to make sure that basically the most interesting thing about the fund was that we were investing in water. Everything else, I wanted an off-the-shelf LPA that was basically the most boring thing that anybody had ever seen. And I wanted to make sure that the LPAC, because they were taking a chance on somebody who's relatively unproven, that, you know, if we're going to get out there, that they had the wherewithal to be able to, you know, to work with me and for me to work with them in terms of, you know, how much time we need to go. But as we, you know, our company's did 54 million in bookings last year, 27 million in revenue. You don't like, especially for a 30 million fund, you know, depending on where you put the multiple, there are different flavors of revenue within that, whether you're looking at software multiples, hardware multiples, whatever it is, it's not perfect. You know, this isn't a 250 million fund like now, but
of course
it's exactly where we would want to be. Yeah, there's no reason why, you know, I need to march up to my LPs and say I need a 15-year fund. Like, there's tons of businesses to be built in water that can make sense on a 7 to 10 year time frame.
So I'm going to combine a couple of other questions I had, which is around the value you bring to your portfolio companies. I guess having done this, I mean, previously you worked in an accelerator in water, and now you're building a fund in it. How can you just speak a little bit to the compounding effect of being kind of very, very particular in this space? And obviously there's learnings you come along the way, network, et cetera, that you're probably able to add other value. But can you just talk about this, broadly speaking, the idea of compounding when you really focus on one thing for a very long time?
Yeah. It's a really cute question. Nobody's ever asked us in the context of compounding, but that really is that really is how we think about it. So I'll come at it from a slightly different angle. So when you run VC through like Helmer's Seven Powers, and I much prefer that to the Five Forces, it's much more user-friendly, the sort of understanding of, I always get confused between kind of supplier power and buyer power. It might be because I'm not very smart, but Helmer's Seven Powers, the way in which we use it, right? When you run it down, VC is not a great business. It really isn't. There's not a huge amount to sort of, you know, stop you in. Everybody's green looks very green, similarly green to other people. So you've got to understand upon what business, what basis are you going to differentiate? And you kind of end up on brand, right? And for a for an early fund, like for the reason why there are such entrenched incumbents, and sometimes people can come in usually by using another one of Lahelma's set of hours, especially counter positioning. Hello, Andreessen Horowitz. Especially counter positioning. But really, brand is what? Brand is what it is. And the brand is seriously important. And in the end, brand comes from DPI and outrageous success. And that's why you, have the top table and tier one firms. It is what it is because the results have been set. That's great. On the way there, you have to be like very clear about how you want to be perceived by your target audience. And because we're so focused, we're not trying to be perceived in one way by a battery company, or a consumer SaaS company, or like whatever it is. We need to be perceived in a way by water companies, and that is people who take the water incredibly seriously, are deeply knowledgeable about the water sector, and are deeply knowledgeable about company building. Is there room for improvement in all of those things? Yes, absolutely. We are still surprised every day by a whole bunch of different things, but we are really committed to learning. But then we also have the focus also pops up in a couple of other places, like cornered resource. Now, I am not a cornered I am underwhelming and British and have less hair than I did, and and I don't mind humiliating myself on stages, which is actually quite a useful thing. But we have some really interesting cornered resources in our firm. My two partners are both called cornered resources. They are, well, not to dehumanize them, because both Christine and Steve are awesome. But Christine built and sold Water Analytics to Xylem. She's an exited digital founder. PhD in data science, is like radically awesome and understands everything digital inside out and up to front, inside out and back to front. And then Steve has been at the coalface of hard tech in water for many a decade and is the highest regarded hard tech mind, I think, in water. And they work for us. They don't work for anyone else. Our venture partners, Wayne and Paul, Wayne Byrne and Paul Holfen, both similarly absolutely excellent, both exited founders from Oxfam and Cedaru, respectively. So we're doing a little bit of that. But then also the other one is network effects. Now, it's not the same as the classic network effects, but we are a group of people. I really do think that Burnt Islanders, which is what we call our portfolio, Burnt Islanders is a group that other founders want to be a part of because they're very, very, very strong. And frankly, they can be more helpful to each other than we can be directly. Metrics that we reported to our LPs at our AGM the other day is that we had 1,000 direct messages in Q4 of last year that we don't see. This is just communication that's happening without our knowledge. This is just our portfolio working together, sharing information. And that is unbelievably powerful. And I really learned that through IH2O. But otherwise, I wish I had more, and I'm still feeling very guilty about not having more kind of war stories at the beginning. Hopefully we can come back to the stuff that is nasty and horrible. And I got extremely wrong before we finish. But what we do is we think about network introduction, so customer, investor, and then smart people who understand water and have been through what people are going through before. We think about marketing invisibility, so being able to shout into a market louder with us than they're able to on their own. And we think about entrepreneurial process, like don't tread on landmines, and especially don't tread on landmines that other people have trod on and that we've told you not to tread on. And then when you do, it all gets very frustrating. That does still happen. But focus helps all of that. Our network is deeper. Our understanding of who is going to be like a more productive target in terms of, filling out a round or doing follow-on funding is more productive. We know more people who could be potential customers. We understand more about the entrepreneurial process in water than anyone else. And that's only going to get more true. So you are absolutely right. It is an exercise in compounding. And, I'm the huge believer in limiting your denominator. Just means that the numbers are higher.
Yeah, I really like this, especially because you brought up in one of your kind of differentiators being people who have, just deep expertise in a space and they don't work anywhere else. Obviously, being in talent, that's always my objective for startups to hire the best people. But yeah. There's actually, I didn't think about this before, but it's very fascinating that if you're just kind of circling in a particular domain, a VC can have the opportunity to be the person who attracts some of those top kind of advisors. So you don't, you know, each startup doesn't have to go find those advisors if they're all kind of conglomerated in one particular place, right?
Yeah, I think that's fair. But it's one of these things that is actually probably, if I was underwriting us, and maybe I shouldn't say this out loud, especially on something that's going to be released into the general public, but it's a very interesting place. So we are at the bottom of our S-curve. Like, people are always like, show me where the exits are. Like, we've had some like really interesting exits, including three onto the public markets. And, you know, Cambrian just raised 200 million and Gradient raised 275 million. We have our first unicorns and all the rest of it. But we are at the beginning of our S-curve. In terms of the really major exits, they're going to make this market and they're going to make water obvious, because water is going to be obvious. Fintech was treated as a joke in 2008. Nobody remembers this. Everyone assumes that fintech's always been an awesome market. One of my LPs was a YC founder in 2008 and was talking to a very major YC founder in 2008 who runs an extremely large fintech company. And they were laughing that everybody like thought fintech was a joke in 2008. Same thing's going to happen to water. Will it happen on the same time frame? No idea. But we're at the beginning of our S-curve, and part of the S-curve journey is going to be some really quite interesting exits. But what comes from the exits is not just proof points in terms of water being a productive market from the venture side of things. It's also incredibly important in terms of talent, in that people who have gone through that process then recycle themselves into the startups they also become useless things like VCs and whatever, right? They recycle themselves into the role. So the CMO that did that thing is now the CMO that people who were part of the marketing operations then go into the next rung up in terms of marketing and operations, whatever it is, in terms of the companies that are coming up the curve behind them. So you get this incredibly important cycle of talent that comes through that really only explodes when you have the largest exits like coming out relatively regularly. It builds that ecosystem of talent, of people who have been there and done that in terms of building companies from zero to exit. Mm-hmm. We don't have a zillion of those people within water. We've got incredibly talented people, but this is the vanguard. This is the vanguard of the people that are coming up, and it's a really exciting time to be a part of it. But it does make us slightly trickier to underwrite.
Yeah, this is part of the reason I also got pretty bored with renewables, because doing recruitment in that space, it got to a point where it's like, it wasn't actually that hard to find people. It was just hard to convince them to change jobs.
Yeah, totally. Yeah, exactly. Like, right, at least really much of a muchness. No, we can't have the energy people. Thank you, the energy people, for everything you do. I much appreciate it.
Being in this space, what are the biggest problems within kind of water broadly that you would bring attention to most people that just the average person is not aware of, these problems in the world?
Oi, oi, oi. I mean, water is so underappreciated that, it boggles the mind. It boggles the mind. It is absolutely fundamental to our existence, and especially in the Western world, we do not care at all. And it's insane. So, I mean, if the stuff that's coming around you, it's hard to get, like, especially in terms of the part of our home market, it's hard to get past contaminants. So just to choose two, PFAS, lead, if you're not aware of those stories, become aware of them, like really soon. It's really important that you understand what is going on, out there in terms of the quality of the water that, especially the most vulnerable people in your society are kind of being forced to ingest. It's really not good. But it is getting more visible, which is incredibly important. What's very rarely talked about is that we're really interesting, that there are very much kind of parallels with the telecoms world, and that we're going through our own leapfrog moment in water, especially for the global south, which is decentralized water and wastewater infrastructure. Much more on the drinking water side of things. Wastewater is okay. Sanitation has proved to be extremely difficult. There are people making some really interesting progress against the sanitation side of things, but it's really, really tough. Bill Gates is really smart, and the people who work for him are really smart. But the Reinvent the Toilet Challenge hasn't yielded the results that maybe it could have done. And that's no shade on anyone. But this is markets that operate according to a set of like fundamental economic assumptions that make business models quite tricky to build. But we're seeing some really interesting companies emerge, which is great. I think people underestimate how heavy water is. So a meter cubed weighs a metric ton. And just get out a meter ruler. It's not that big. A metric ton is really heavy, and we move an awful lot of water around. And it means that everywhere water goes, there is embedded energy. And so there's a huge amount of embedded energy use, which obviously usually means CO2 emissions. But even going beyond that, the water emissions nexus is really important. So we think the water is at a minimum about 10% of global emissions, and everybody within the emission side of things doesn't care about water. And it is annoying. And this is a theme. I'll shut up about it. But the, especially in terms of fugitive methane with a carbon factor of 24, I think it's been a little bit time since I did it. And then a nitrous oxide's emissions factor of 300. So nitrous oxide, laughing gas, comes off almost all wastewater facilities. And, you know, it's 300 times as potent a greenhouse gas as carbon dioxide is. And then the last thing is that people really don't understand is that water vapor is an incredibly potent greenhouse gas. Now, I wish I had the carbon factor to hand. But as the world heats up, probably the scariest feedback loop is that the higher the amount of moisture in the air, not only do you get more extremes of precipitation, but also drought, is that that water vapor itself is incredibly effective at trapping heat. And so there's kind of a feedback loop between water and climate that we're only just starting to get to grips with. I mean, on the problems, like, flip them and you've got opportunities, right? Mm-hmm.
Yeah,
there is an
exactly.
awful lot of stuff to be solved. And this is why when GWI estimate that, you know, 3.6 trillion in water scarcity today is going to, or water security today is going to become $12.4 trillion a year by 2034, it's not an outlandish statement in the slightest. Then WWF, assessing that about 60% of global GDP is predicated on water and its associated ecosystem services. Mm-hmm. 60% of GDP on something that is completely ignored by the private and, frankly, the public market. Mm-hmm. It's just a wildly exciting opportunity.
Yeah, that's why I always ask people, you know, what are those problems? Because you need more builders in that space. You know, we're getting close to the end. One thing I like to advise candidates I work with when they're kind of picking where they want to work and just career advice is, if they know an industry they want to work in, go to the center, near the epicenter of that place. Where do you see globally the most innovation happening if it's conglomerated in one space, in water tech or water broadly? So if somebody really wants to work in the space, they're going to go, you know, move their family or move their life there so they can be part of it.
Yeah, I was going to say something trite, like Brooklyn, where I live, because it's very selfish and I would very much like it. Though actually, the New York City is doing some really, really interesting stuff. They are the first city that is actually taking, I mean, they call it the blue economy, also happens. But they're actually taking that idea relatively seriously, and there are going to be some quite interesting announcements over the next 2 to 3 years, and it's great. But there isn't one. Like everywhere else in technology, we've got the highest concentration of the burnt islanders that live in the Bay Area. But it's only 3 out of 18. We have 5 companies that are ex-US. The others are scattered across from Pittsburgh to Kansas City to South Carolina to Boston to, well, New York. So all over the place. There really isn't necessarily a place to go. And there isn't one that I would point to. Maybe on balance, just about the Bay Area. And then I would say, if people are just interested in the science of company building, we left the Bay Area about 18 months ago after 8.5 years. And I cannot tell you how profoundly grateful I was to that time in San Francisco. Everyone is like hating on San Francisco. This is nonsense and everything's like open air sewer and all that stuff. Does that have its drawbacks? Sure. Like, as a British person who, when I graduated from university, the idea that I would be doing anything to do with startups, let alone starting a fund to support, were so far away from like anything that would be possible. But there is a generosity about the place that I would absolutely not be sitting here without it. And I think it has to be seen to be believed. And I think it really does have to be lived to be believed. It really is profound. But the most important thing is the tacit expectations of while you're there. And it's that everybody's sort of expecting you to be doing your own thing. And sometimes that can come across as patronizing and also very annoying when people are just talking about like startups and VC and all this kind of shit. Like it can be really annoying, right? And it's not the most like diverse place in the world, not only in terms of the gender and racial makeup of it, but also in terms of just people's kind of like outlooks. It's just, it can be annoying in that sense, but just living that like sense of expectation that it's only risk. It's only building something. It's only starting something. It's not this big monster where if you fail, you've got to crawl under a rock for the rest of your life. It's like failure is like celebrated. And there is something unbelievably liberating about it. But New York is getting there. But this is like, that is San Francisco's real secret sauce. A lot of that has to do with the generosity of the people there. So I would recommend it to anyone.
Yeah, that's quite interesting. This is I've never been to SF yet, but I know that a lot of people were souring on it over the past months.
Yeah,
but it seems as though
jumpers.
It's
they're all coming back from Austin and Miami now.
Exactly, it seems like SF is on the rise again, and it's something
it's
quite interesting.
Place.
You know, being somebody from the Midwest, you know, with none of this kind of exposure to startups, I feel quite lucky to be working, you know, with founders in the space, but
Midwest,
I think
Dublin's in Kansas City, crazy awesome Ziptility, Tyler's in Pittsburgh, absolutely phenomenal. Like we just see absolutely amazing founders from all over the place.
Awesome. Well, we're almost at the end of time here, but I think probably just maybe a self-indulging moment. I'm an innovation junkie is how I call myself. Can you talk a little bit about just like really quickly, rapid fire, some of the companies that you work with that are doing really cool things, just like the TLDR of what they're doing in the company name?
Well, I'll give you the first three investments coming out of Fund 2, which might not sound cool. They are cool. And if you don't think they sound cool, then you're wrong. The first one is a heat pump water heater company. I'm not actually allowed to name it, but it's from Boston. The structure of the heat pump water heater market is really interesting because it's been owned by a duopoly, a collusive duopoly that owned 90% of the market, the water heater market. And so when the heat pump water heater came out, essentially what they did was put a crap piece of plastic on their existing design because they didn't want to rewire their production lines. They only pursue incremental innovation and that leaves them vulnerable. If you actually organize around the heat pump, there are so many things, up to and including making your water heater a battery and make it eligible for load management credits from the grid, which completely transforms the economics of it. Anyway, this company is going to go after that. And I think we think that the heat pump water heater market doubled last year to 2 billion. 100% growth. It's at the beginning of its S curve. And then it just happens that this water heater reduces household water use by 20% because of the quality of the interface between the water heater and what they're doing. But they're going to be launching in September, wildly excellent team coming out of the energy efficiency market. The second one is a phenomenal company called Hope Hydration, which is a really, really good example of business model innovation. So water access, huge problem all over the place. It would be really great if we could provide water for free. What else do we provide for free? Like social media platforms, search, what pilots it? Advertising. So what happens if you can overlap like clean, reliable, just freely available water, but just associate it with an advert? Like that's as powerful in Times Square, which is like Hope Hydration just sold its second really quite lucrative contract for Times Square. You can go to the bleachers in Times Square, and just at the left of you look at them, there's Hope's unit. But they also just did the first F1 race of the season. They're doing Coachella. They've got deals with some really, really interesting people. But it's as true for New York as it is for New Delhi. And that's what's really powerful about it, is that it could potentially be the engine for a huge amount of water access worldwide. And Jorge is just doing an absolutely extraordinary job. They did $500K in revenue in the first quarter of this year without really thinking about it. It's awesome. And then the third one is a fantastic company called Subeca. This is one of those water companies that we love where their first market just happens to be in water. One of the water's crazy guarded secrets is that while everything else is throwing off data, 55% of the water meters still have to be read manually in the US in 2024. It is absolutely insane. And Subeca's kind of core IoT unit, which actually is applicable to a huge amount of a whole bunch of other use cases where it is also insane that this is the case in 2024. This should be throwing off data. It doesn't, because it's actually really complicated to be able to do what Subeca has done. The first market they're going after is water meters, but they've also got a huge amount of adjacencies just from their core technology. And they're going to be the first first outside technology on a very, very large company's connectivity platform, which is going to be, and that pie-up is going to be announced relatively soon. Huge potential company in the IoT side of things. We're looking at another company in AI, we're looking at another company in stormwater. There's just a ton of really interesting stuff, but much more importantly, there are a ton of problems to work on. And it's still relatively low hanging fruit. You know, again, whether you call it 1.4 trillion or whether you call it 3.6 trillion, like, you just throw a cat and you see a market that is big enough and filled with dumb stuff that needs to be fixed. So we just think that more and more people should come and join in.
Yeah. I guess last thing would be, if you were forced today to go start your own water tech company, you couldn't be an investor anymore, you had to go build the company yourself. What problem would you go and solve?
There are a lot of quite interesting ones here. I would go and drive a bus through the water testing market. So the water testing market, and it's it's basically populated by incumbents that take about 2 to 2.5 weeks to turn around a water test. And when they do, they give it to you to 9 decimal places for the illusion of accuracy. But it's almost always wrong when you actually hold it up to it's insane. But the thing that annoys me most about it, and it really does suck, is that if you're getting water samples back only every 2.5 weeks, if you're a water company, you can only really run 26 experiments a year. Now, that's not quite right for the same reason as stuff falling off the end. But like, the feedback loops need to be much, 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 much tighter. But just businesses where people have been able to harvest cash for ages while sucking, like, are really annoying. And there are a few examples of them, but that's the one that I would like to drive a coach and horses through, as they say in the old country.
Very nice. That's probably the best answer we've ever had in terms of that question. Normally it's very vague, but that's very good.
There's all sorts of stuff that I want to go after.
Very nice. Well, awesome. This has really been a pleasure. I actually really, really enjoyed this episode. Where should people reach you? Any calls to action?
Yeah, sure. So I'm embarrassingly easy to find, just tom@burntisleventures.com. But, you will see on our website, really easy to find us. So if you're a founder or anybody that's interested in knowing more about what we do, do just give us a shout. And then in terms of the call to action, I would just ask people to notice that in the $1.4 trillion of the IRA, which excludes the $250 billion that was given to the Loan Programs Office, water was almost entirely excluded. And we need to understand why. And it's because water story is really not told well enough. And it starts with people noticing that. So when you go to bed tonight and you're brushing your teeth, or you're having a shower or whatever it is, or you're going to the bathroom, toilet humor, one of the advantages of working in water, just be grateful, because that the ability to do that is the result of a phenomenal amount of expertise that hides in the science of our society, never noticed. And they allow this society to exist. And I think the more that we think about the role of water and what we do, then all sorts of good things happen. We become more receptive to storytelling. Hopefully we can change our votes. We can change the pressure that we put on our elected representatives. And then obviously we buy more cool stuff, which will help the Burnt Islands. But yeah, that would be the one call to action. It's just notice.
Very good. That's also a killer call to action. So thanks for that. This has been a pleasure. We'll have to have you on again, and definitely, send us some of your portfolio companies, and we'll get them on the show.
Certainly will. Thank you so much, Silas. It's been a real pleasure. Thank you so much for having me.
Welcome to the takeaway section, where we ramble on about the things we are just obsessed with and try to make it interesting. Let's get into it. So really hard to pick the best points from today because there were so many good things that Tom had. But I think I must give the first place to how freaking funny Tom is. You know, as he mentioned, he has an interest in theater, and I feel that to some extent, this is a huge advantage to him and may be a big contributor to his success. I mean, when people are likable, self-deprecating, and kind of give you a laugh, it makes you someone that others really want to be in business with. And, you know, perhaps some founders will take notes and, you know, maybe join their local Toastmasters or try some stand-up comedy. Maybe you should practice before you try that. You don't want to be scarred for life if things go poorly. You know, I certainly feel as though I should take some of these lessons afterwards, because Thomas, just his interest in kind of that side of things, I have a feeling has been a really big kind of point as to why he succeeded in this regard. I certainly am drawn to Tom. I want to work with him. You know, I want to be part of his circle, essentially, right? After this conversation, especially. Second point is his point about the moat that comes from a longer sales cycle. So first of all, as he noted, the need for founders to recognize that things take a long time in water. But if you listen carefully, you'll see that they don't change their fund return horizon, and they don't tell their portfolio companies to drag their feet or to anticipate a longer, time horizon before raising their next round. They just tell them to be aware of it and proceed accordingly. Proceed as if every step matters, really, right? And in the end, when you're super successful at this market, when you land and deal with these lead times, you end up with a moat because of how difficult it is to get these sales, right? And on that point, he pointed out a huge secret about hardware. When you land the sales are usually huge, right? This leads to the final point, the importance of unit economics. So without the right understanding of the life cycle of the sale and the unit economics, none of this would work. You need to build in the process so that you win and the customer also wins. He cited several times where the companies do have huge ticket prices on their products, but going back to what he said at the beginning, it must be affordable because it's water. And if it's too expensive, it's a non-starter. To try to bring this point home, I'll just re-highlight what he said, which I just thought was quite funny, honestly. It has to be a borderline fireable offense to not install the solution you're making. That's how good it has to be. Okay, enough for me. Enjoy the rest of your day, and we'll see you next time on Clean Techies.